When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised this podcast contains the names of people who have died. Welcome to Australia on this day. I'm Michael Adams, and today we're going back to the 15th of July 1968. That was the day that Jim Bowler, an Australian geologist, made a discovery that literally rewrote our history books. I'm very pleased to tell you that Jim was good enough to give me an interview, and you'll hear that in a moment. But first, a little background. Jim Bowler was born in 1930 and raised on an onion farm in Leongatha in South Gippsland, Victoria. Growing up in the Great Depression, Jim helped his family work the soil. Then, as a teenager, he went to a Jesuit seminary to train to be a missionary. Jim lasted 9 months before deciding that the priesthood wasn't for him. He returned to the farm where his father gave him a few acres on which he grew potatoes for the next decade. During this time, Jim also educated himself via correspondence, and in the mid-1950s, he began his formal tertiary education and extended his knowledge of the land beneath his feet by studying geology at the University of Melbourne. Jim Bowler graduated in 1958. He got a master's degree 3 years later and then, in 1965, moved to Canberra to become a research fellow at the Australian National University. Jim's area of interest was climate change and how it had shaped the Australian continent, particularly with respect to the vast, now dry lakes of the outback. In 1968, Jim was in Western New South Wales. He was studying eroded dune formations around the edges of an ancient lake at Balandra. At this time, it was believed that the human habitation of Australia had begun only 20,000 years ago, and that was based on evidence of Aboriginal occupation found far away in the north of the continent. What's also important to know is that through the 19th century and well into the 20th century, anthropologists, phrenologists and others thought Aborigines were primitive people who might prove to be the so-called missing link between apes and humans. This belief had led to a busy trade in robbing Aboriginal burial sites, particularly for skulls to be used in cranial profiling that might confirm this missing link theory. But 52 years ago today, on the ancient shores of what we now know as Lake Mungo, land traditionally owned by the Parkenti, Nyampa and Mutti Mutti tribal groups, geologist Jim Bowler was seeing archaeological evidence that would lead to two discoveries that had turned those notions and our history upside down. You hear a lot from me in this podcast as it is, so apart from a few questions, this episode is just Jim telling his story. A note, the Aboriginal women that Jim mentions are the late Alice Kelly, a pioneering elder, and Mary Pappin, also an elder, and both were advocates for the return to country of Mungo Lady and Mungo Man. Jim, what were you finding at Lake Mungo in terms of evidence of human habitation in these ancient dunes?
My early days at Lake Mungo, I found myself, I was mapping the shoreline of the lakes. There were beaches and gravel sands, which I knew were the signal of the high lake level. So walking along and mapping those features, I kept coming across flaked stones and where they should not be, and then freshwater shells sitting high on the dune, where they could not have been transported naturally. So there was evidence that I was walking in the footsteps of people who'd been there a long time before me.
How long are we talking?
The age of the dunes, we knew, was associated with the last cold glacial phase about 20,000 years ago. These shells were lying within the sediments of those dunes built 20,000 years ago, so that I knew immediately that this was evidence of very of ancient occupation.
And in 1968, what was the accepted view in terms of how long Indigenous people had inhabited the continent of Australia?
Well, at that time, the work of Carmel Shearer in the Northern Territory had established the ages as about 20,000 years. But I was noticing shells well below the level of the 20,000-year dunes. So the evidence there was considerably older than 20,000 years. And it was that was the message I was taking, that I took back to my colleagues in my archaeological colleagues in Canberra, where I was told politely that I was a geologist, I didn't really know much about archaeology, and that I should stick to my stones and leave the evidence of archaeology to those who are better trained. I was even more determined to show that there was evidence of people there much earlier.
This was clearly evidence of habitation more than 25,000 years ago. Why were your colleagues so determined not to believe physical evidence?
Oh, I think there was no previous record of that kind from that part of Australia, and it was older than I was sort of stepping back the age of human occupation. This was older than the evidence in the Northern Territory at that stage, so that now, this challenge to archaeology coming from a non-archaeologist, coming from a geologist, was not greeted with a great deal of excitement.
But you were sure that you were right?
Yes, I was satisfied. The discovery, virtually by accident as it happened, as I was walking back from recording the presence of shells, to find weathering out from a block of soil, a block of ancient soil, soil carbonate, contained burnt bones. And burnt bones, that was the indication of human activity. Somebody had lit a fire, and there was a big ceremonial fire at that place and these remnants of bones, which I thought at the time were probably of food, were signaled to me that the antiquity now was way beyond 20,000 years, and here it was sitting in clear definition of ancient human presence. So that was the evidence I took back to my archaeological colleagues, and even then, for a long term, it took 9 months before I was able to encourage a team to come and evaluate this site specifically. And that occurred in early 1969, and as I had deliberately left those bones undisturbed until it was evaluated, and that is precisely what happened.
If you can just tell me what it was like 52 years ago today when you came across these bones. What was the day like? What were you thinking? What did you feel?
Well, I was going about my normal geological business, but it was a moment of great delight when I was able to identify that these burnt bones were emerging from what I called then an oven, an Aboriginal a site that was clearly developed at the hands of people. The antiquity was quite secure because it was cemented into an ancient soil. The 20,000-year-old dune had been stripped off the top, and we're well back beyond 20,000 years. We were in a time frame beyond the accepted period of human occupation. So I was pretty chuffed at finding those bones, but it took a long time. It took another 9 months before they were actually determined as not just burnt bones of a meal, but the bones of a human body, the cremation, which we now know, of Mungo Lady. But that, so it took 9 months before the next stage of excitement really burst upon us.
On that day, 52 years ago, did you think, wow, I have just rewritten history?
There was clearly a sense that, yes, we had, this was an entirely new chapter in history, and it was complicated, or perhaps amplified, by the realisation that the Aboriginal people had endured a century of improper evaluation of their skeletal remains. The Australian Aborigines particularly were of interest to people like Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, and he was analysing Aboriginal skeletons to try and show that they were perhaps connected to Neanderthals. There was almost an industry amongst university anatomists in Melbourne, Sydney, and the export of skeletons from Australia to other parts of the world. Scandalous treatment of Aboriginal remains. And I was closely, I was aware of a gentleman from my own environment there, Leon Gather, Murray Black, who in our local town was known to be a major collector of skeletons. He collected them by the truckload. So I had interviewed Murray Black, and I had already become aware of this totally unjust treatment of Aboriginal skeletons. So that was in the background of my mind. So when the Mungo Lady discovery came along, this was the first encounter with the actual nature of the human body of ancient Aboriginal people. The opportunity now to discover, you know, what they were like. Certainly not Neanderthals, but it took another 9 months before Alan Thorne, my colleague, now deceased, reconstructed the cranium of that, what we know now as Mungo Lady. And that cranium proved to be fully modern. The remains of a person just like us. That was mind-blowing. That was the end of all that industry of human biology trying to show that the ancient Aboriginal people was in some ways morphologically inferior.
So previous so-called scientist grave robbers had been trying to demonstrate that Australian Aboriginal people were a missing link, correct?
That's exactly the case. And we have in the University of Melbourne and in Sydney, my colleagues in those days, Professor McIntosh, he was busily collecting skeletons across the country to evaluate that concept, so that the atmosphere in those days, the climate of inquiry, was still trying to explore the possibility that the early Australian occupants were an early Homo erectus version of mankind. Mungo Lady changed all of that.
So once Mungo Lady had been reconstructed by Alan Thorne and shown to be a modern human being, how did you feel about, and dated to approximately 42,000 years ago, how did you feel about her existence and then the discovery 6 years later that you made of Mungo Man?
The cranium of Mungo Lady was once the site of a loving, emotional, a fully human person, just like me, so that there is an immediate connection, as quite distinct from the treatment of fossil bones. Well, the fossil animal, diprotodon or a dinosaur, they're entirely different. It's the connection by shared consciousness. Human remains present us with a degree, with a connection between the observer and the observed. We have a relationship. So I immediately realized in my humanity was shared by the bones or the original occupants of those bones of Mungo Lady. And when the dating became clear, 40 to 42,000 years, that occurred 35,000 years before the patriarch Abraham. Abraham, the foundation figure of Jewish Islam and Christianity, Mungo Lady, and later the exciting exposure of Mungo Man, demonstrated that 35,000 years before any of those religions, the people of Australia shared a relationship with the land. They shared a concept, an understanding of who they were in relationship with the land with which in which they lived. And that's the same land that I was looking at. We shared the same lake, the same sand dune. As it were, we drew waters from the same well. Our identity in consciousness was expanded by realization that we shared the same landscape, the same very lake waters. So that was a connection which completely changed my relationship with those objects of human remains. No longer non-human, they came to life. And of course, when the Aboriginal elders later became aware of how science had now was expanding that concept of their presence in the country, that opened a new door between the elders, the first elders, Alice Kelly, Mutty Mutty Lady from Balranald, whose voice was heard in the early 1980s when she became a representative in the committee of advisory committee of the Lake Mungo National Park. Alice Kelly immediately identified with Mungo Lady, and not only identified with, but Mungo Lady became almost a saintly figure in the eyes of Alice Kelly, a saintly figure, a revered figure, because Mungo Lady returned, was never excavated, returned to the surface to tell us her story. Alice Kelly took that story to heart, and she lived that continuity over 40,000 years with those early ancestral people from whom she and other Aboriginal people now derive their identity.
Jim, can I just ask, what was the significance of the way that Mungo Lady's bones had been buried and the significance of how Mungo Man's skeleton had been buried? And what did that tell us about who they were and who their community was?
The ritual of Mungo Lady and the later the ritual of Mungo Man provided an entirely new picture of this cultural sophistication of those earliest Australians 40,000 years ago. None of us had ever imagined the degree of sophisticated ritual that was enacted in those burials. Mungo Lady, with a cremation, the burning of the bones, the fire, collection of the fire, the community involvement in that exercise was more than matched by the ritual burial of Mungo Man found just 5 years later.
If you could just talk me through what happened that day, and could you believe that you'd made a second discovery so close to where you discovered Mungo Lady?
So the discovery a few years later of Mungo Man added an entirely new chapter. Mungo Man was found on one morning after heavy rain. I decided to wander off and see if anything new had appeared at the surface, as often happens after heavy rain. And there, in the distance, I spotted a tip of a white bone emerging from the sand. When I brushed the sand away, it was clearly a part of a human cranium, and it was sitting there, not lying there, in position, only the tip of the cranium involved. I brushed away the sand, and there was the mandible, the teeth, the jawbone was there. So I immediately contacted my colleagues in Canberra, and they returned very quickly, within 2 days, and carried out, we call it an excavation, but it wasn't really an excavation in the true sense. It was merely the brushing away of the sand that remained from after the top 4 or 5 meters of dune sand had been stripped away. Here, this skeleton was appearing at the surface. And to our surprise, we found a fully articulated human remains stretched out very carefully on a grave cut into the sands of the Lake Mungo shoreline, and carefully prepared, laid out carefully with the full extended skeleton of what turned out to be an adult male, a tall man, about 170 centimetres. And it was a surprise to us to find that in the excavation we found pellets of ochre, of that iron oxide, of great treasure to Aboriginal people. The ochre for painting, for anointing, for the definition of things sacred, had been used to embalm or anoint the skeleton of this person in the grave. That was a shattering discovery. There was no ochre in that landscape for several hundred kilometres. It had to be imported by the community. It had to be ground into a dust or a paste to be placed onto the body. And that represented an extraordinary ritual of a kind way beyond our imagination. And it was associated simultaneously with a large fireplace, a fire located near the foot of the grave. So when we reconstruct the time of that event at 40 to 42,000 years ago, the people, the word had gone out. Someone, the man was dying. The ochre had been collected, the grave dug, the fire lit and the fireplace established. The use of fire, that cleansing smoke which is used in the ritual ceremony of Aboriginal descendants to this very day, to realise that that ritual enacted out there 40,000 years ago, the equivalent of a sacred requiem in any cathedral across the world. There on the cathedral shores of the lake, that enacting, the grief, the mourning, and the recognition that there was something beyond death, that the use of the fire, the anointing by ochre, the representation that the connection with the lake, with the sand, with the sea, the landscape, these people were connected to that country. They were expressing their connection between the world they lived in and the departure of from life of this obviously eminent member of their community. So that ritual, and it remains a mystery to me today, to realize that happened here in Australia 40,000 years ago is almost still beyond my imagination. Certainly, it's one of continuing challenge. I contemplate it frequently because that man, like me, we've tried to restore the environment of the day, as it were, we've tried to, as it were, put flesh back on that man's bones. And in a sense, Mungo Man and Mungo Lady have come to life. Their spirit is seen in continuity with their Aboriginal descendants today. That's a matter for continued mystery and contemplation to me. When I look at Aboriginal people today, connect them back to those people, people just like us, 40,000 years ago, stands as a monumental mystery in this understanding in Australia of who we are, who they were, and how that affects how we stand in collegiate association with their descendants today. So those rituals, Michael, are very pertinent to what's happening in Australia today. We've recently witnessed the great outpouring of the Black Lives Matter protest of the way in which Aboriginal people, dark people across the world, have been treated, exploited by science, devastated by imperial conquest, stripped of their land, and almost in many cases dehumanized. Now the Mungo Lady, the Mungo people, stand in evidence to demonstrate the falsity of that perception. They stand side by side with those protesters in the streets of Black Lives Matter. Now, simultaneously, those ancient lives matter. Not only did they matter, but they've brought treasured elements to our understanding today. But also, essentially, we remember that they were, as it were, representative, or were represented later by 20 to 30,000 people, men and women, who died on the same soil defending their land from against people like my ancestors who came and occupied this country and devastated the original people. So those rituals, Michael, are not just symbolically relevant. They have foundational meaning to the present outpouring of concern for the restoration of Indigenous rights. That's an issue that we are now becoming more accustomed to confront. So it's in that context, Michael, that I can say that those Mungo people helped provide a major step in the production of the new story that is awaited in Australia. We await that story of the past people to understand where we are in the present dialogue with Aboriginal people today.
Now, it was also very important to repatriate Mungo Lady and Mungo Man back to their country. How glad were you to see that happen in 1992 and 2017, respectively?
Oh, that was a long-awaited healing process. That was one in which, as it were, bonded the links between the scientists like myself and the Aboriginal people who had protested at the injustice of the way they were treated, and they saw injustice in our removal of those bones. The repatriation of those bones was the healing moment when we joined together. We stood on the sand and celebrated the return home. There was a passion, there was weeping, and a commitment to the future. That was a monumental moment in the towards a completion of that whole story. But it's still, Michael, far from complete. Those bones, the bones of Mungo Lady and Mungo Man, there is still no resting place for them. They have been in the care of the traditional owners, but they have been neglected entirely by government and by bureaucratic management and both the state of New South Wales and the Commonwealth. Responsibility for World Heritage Management has been almost utterly neglected out there. The Aboriginal people have been left without support, without indication of the way forward. They're the dialogue between the Aboriginal traditional owners and the rest of the Australian community has not been happening. It has not been assisted by the bureaucratic management. The World Heritage Area has stood for the last seven years entirely without any structured management. It's only 6 months ago that a new chair has been appointed, but that chairmanship has been absent for the last seven years. So the whole presence of the Lake Mungo and the Willandra Lakes World Heritage Area has fallen off the national radar screen. The educational agenda that the World Heritage Area has to deliver has yet to be made available to the Australian community.
What do we risk losing without proper management of the World Heritage Area in terms of its preservation and in terms of educational opportunities?
The educational dimension is of such scale. It's the story of the land and the people. It's the story of the geology of the landscape in which people lived, they managed and protected for now well beyond 40,000 years. The Mungo story, with the presence of the actual, the reconstruction of the actual people of Mungo Lady and Mungo Man, that provides the keystone to the educational future of not only that area, but of what it means to be Australian. It is that conjunction of land and people, of the landscape and the story of their people, of people's occupancy, that forms the basis for a new story of what it means to be Australian. That is now the next step. We need to define the vision for that World Heritage Area. We have the opportunity of a new awareness in the wide Australian community of the need to build those connections, the cross-cultural connections between Western technological society and the Indigenous people who have cared for this country for so long. That is that opportunity now is opening up for us. It's there in the Black Lives Matter movement. It's there in the genuine concern for reconciliation. The challenge now is to deliver to the Australian people the story of the Mungo people, the rich cultural reality of the ancient Aboriginal Australians and their relationship to the cultural to their descendants today.
Jim, just finally, do you think, I mean, in both instances, you discovered Mungo Lady and Mungo Man in almost serendipitous, well, they were serendipitous circumstances. Is there a feeling that they found you?
Oh, look, that's a feeling that Mary Pappin has beautifully expressed. She's alerted me to that. You know, don't go around saying you found Mungo Lady, because it's much better. It is more correct to say they found you. That's Mary Pappin's view. So look, I'm sort of honoured to accept that way, Michael.
All right, Jim. Thank you so much for your time. Lovely talking to you.
Righto, thanks, Michael. Good to catch up with you.
Thanks, mate. Bye bye. I'm Michael Adams, and you've been listening to Australia on This Day. Make sure you're subscribed to get every episode as soon as it's released. If you've enjoyed the show, I'd love it if you could leave a review and rating at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're after more tales from our fascinating history, check out my other show, Forgotten Australia. This podcast was produced in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales on land traditionally owned by the Darug and Gundungurra people. Thanks for listening, and catch you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.